This is Audible.
Audio Connoisseur presents The Jewish War by Josephus, Volume 1.
Before beginning our main history, we present first a brief biographical sketch of the central figures in the Jewish revolt of AD 66, along with a short history of Jerusalem by Sir Charles Watson, Sir Charles Wilson, and John H. Hart. Herod the Great, the son of Antipater. The family seems to have been of Idumean origin, so that its members were liable to the reproach of being half-Jews or even foreigners. Tradition has it that they were originally Philistines of Ascalon, and, on the other hand, Nicolaus of Damascus asserted that Herod, his royal patron, was descended from the Jews who first returned from the Babylonian captivity. The tradition and the assertion are, in all probability, equally fictitious, and proceed respectively from the foes and the friends of the Herodian dynasty. Antipas, or Antipater, the father of Antipater, had been governor of Idumea under Alexander Janneus. His son allied himself by marriage with the Arabian nobility and became the real ruler of Palestine under Hyrcanus II. When Rome intervened in Asia in the person of Pompey, the younger Antipater realized Rome's inevitable predominance and secured the friendship of Rome's representative. After the capture of Jerusalem in 63 BC, Rome installed Hyrcanus, who was little better than a figurehead in the high priesthood. And when, in 55 BC, the son of Aristobulus renewed the civil war in Palestine, the Roman governor of Syria, in the exercise of his jurisdiction, arranged a settlement in accordance with the wishes of Antipater. To this policy of dependence upon Rome, Antipater adhered, and he succeeded in commending himself to Mark Antony and Caesar in turn. After the Battle of Pharsalia, Caesar made him procurator and a Roman citizen. At this point, Herod appears on the scene as ruler of Galilee, appointed by his father at the age of 15, or, since he died at 70, 25. In spite of his youth, he soon found an opportunity of displaying his mettle, for he arrested Hezekiah, the arch-brigand who had overrun the Syrian border, and put him to death. The Jewish nobility at Jerusalem seized upon this high-handed action as a pretext for satisfying their jealousy of their Idumean rulers. Herod was cited in the name of Hyrcanus to appear before the Sanhedrin, whose prerogative he had usurped in executing Hezekiah. He appeared with a bodyguard, and the Sanhedrin was overawed. Only Samius, a Pharisee, dared to insist upon the legal verdict of condemnation. But the governor of Syria had sent a demand for Herod's acquittal, and so Hyrcanus adjourned the trial and persuaded the accused to abscond. Herod returned with an army, but his father prevailed upon him to depart to Galilee without wreaking his vengeance upon his enemies. About this time, around 47 or 46 B.C., he was created strategus of Celesyria by the provincial governor. The episode is important for the light which it throws upon Herod's relations with Rome and the Jews. In 44 BC, Cassius arrived in Syria for the purpose of filling his war chest. Antipater and Herod collected the sum of money at which the Jews of Palestine had been assessed. In 43 BC, Antipater was poisoned at the instigation of one Malichus, who was perhaps a Jewish patriot animated by hatred of the Herods and their Roman patrons. With the connivance of Cassius, Herod had Malichus assassinated, but the country was in a state of anarchy thanks to the extortions of Cassius and the encroachments of neighboring powers. Antony, who became master of the East after Philippi, was ready to support the sons of his friend Antipater. But he was absent in Egypt when the Parthians invaded Palestine to restore Antigonus to the throne of his father Aristobulus, this in 40 BC. Herod escaped to Rome. The Arabians, his mother's people, had repudiated him. Antony had made him tetrarch, and now, with the assent of Octavian, persuaded the Senate to declare him king of Judea. In 39 BC, Herod returned to Palestine, and, when the presence of Antony put the reluctant Roman troops entirely at his disposal, he was able to lay siege to Jerusalem 2 years later. Secure in the support of Rome, he was concerned also to legitimize his position in the eyes of the Jews by taking, for love as well as policy, the Hasmonean princess Mariamne to be his second wife. Jerusalem was taken by storm. The Roman troops withdrew to behead Antigonus the usurper at Antioch. In 37 BC, Herod was king of Judea, being the client of Antony and the husband of Mariamne. The Pharisees, who dominated the bulk of the Jews, were content to accept Herod's rule as a judgment of God. Hyrcanus returned from his prison. Mutilated, he could no longer hold office as high priest, but his mutilation probably gave him the prestige of a martyr, and his influence, whatever it was worth, seems to have been favorable to the new dynasty. On the other hand, Herod's marriage with Mariamne brought some of the enemies into his own household. He had scotched the faction of Hasmonean sympathizers by killing 45 members of the Sanhedrin and confiscating their possessions. But so long as there were representatives of the family alive, there was always a possible pretender to the throne which he occupied, and the people had not lost their affection for their former deliverers. Mariamne's mother used her position to further her plots for the overthrow of her son-in-law, and she found an ally in Cleopatra of Egypt, who was unwilling to be spurned by him even if she was not weary of his patron, Antony. The events of Herod's reign indicate the temporary triumphs of his different adversaries. His high priest, a Babylonian, was deposed in order that Aristobulus III, Mariamne's brother, might hold the place to which he had some ancestral right. But the enthusiasm with which the people received him at the Feast of Tabernacles convinced Herod of the danger, and the youth was drowned by order of the king at Jericho. Cleopatra had obtained from Antony a grant of territory adjacent to Herod's domain, and even part of it. She required Herod to collect arrears of tribute. So it fell out that when Octavian and the Senate declared war against Antony and Cleopatra, Herod was preoccupied in obedience to her commands, and was thus prevented from fighting against the future emperor of Rome. After the Battle of Actium in 31 BC, Herod executed Hyrcanus and proceeded to wait upon the victorious Octavian at Rhodes. His position was confirmed, and his territories were restored. On his return, he took in hand to deal with the Hasmoneans, and in 25 BC, the old intriguers, their victims like Mariamne, and all pretenders were dead. From this time onwards, Herod was free to govern Palestine as a client prince of the Roman Empire should govern his kingdom. In order to put down the brigands who still infested the country and to check the raids of the Arabs on the frontier, he built or rebuilt fortresses which were of material assistance to the Jews in the great revolt against Rome. Within and without Judea, he erected magnificent buildings and founded cities. He established games in honor of the emperor after the ancient Greek model in Caesarea and Jerusalem, and revived the splendor of the Olympic Games. At Athens and elsewhere, he was commemorated as a benefactor, and as Jew and king of the Jews, he restored the temple at Jerusalem. The emperor recognized his successful government by putting the districts of Ulatha and Panias under him in 20 BC. But Herod found new enemies among the members of his household. His brother Pheroras and sister Salome plotted for their own advantage and against the two sons of Mariamne. The people still cherished a loyalty to the Hasmonean lineage, although the young princes were also the sons of Herod. The enthusiasm with which they were received fed the suspicion which their uncle instilled into their father's mind, and they were strangled at Sebaste. On his deathbed, Herod discovered that his eldest son, Antipater, whom Josephus calls a monster of iniquity, had been plotting against him. He proceeded to accuse him before the governor of Syria, and obtained leave from Augustus to put him to death. The father died 5 days after his son, in 4 B.C. He had done much for the Jews, thanks to the favor he had won and kept, in spite of all, from the successive heads of the Roman state. He had observed the law publicly. In fact, as the traditional epigram of Augustus says, "It was better to be Herod's swine than a son of Herod." Herod Antipas, son of Herod the Great by the Samaritan Malthasi, and full brother of Archelaus, received as his share of his father's dominions the provinces of Galilee and Perea, with the title of Tetrarch. Like his father, Antipas had a turn for architecture. He rebuilt and fortified the town of Sepphoris in Galilee. He also fortified Betharampa in Perea, and called it Julius, after the wife of the emperor. Above all, he founded the important town of Tiberias on the west shore of the Sea of Galilee, with institutions of a distinctly Greek character. He reigned from 4 BC until AD 39. In the Gospels, he is mentioned as Herod. It was he who was called a fox by Christ. He is erroneously spoken of as a king in Mark. It was to him that Jesus was sent by Pilate to be tried. But it is in connection with his wife Herodias that he is best known, and it was through her that his misfortunes arose. He was married, first of all, to a daughter of Aretas, the Arabian king, but making the acquaintance of Herodias, the wife of his brother Philip, not the Tetrarch, during a visit to Rome, he was fascinated by her and arranged to marry her. Meantime, his Arabian wife discovered the plan and escaped to her father, who made war on Herod and completely defeated his army. John the Baptist condemned his marriage with Herodias and, in consequence, was put to death in the way described in the Gospels and in Josephus. When Herodias's brother Agrippa was appointed king by Caligula, she was determined to see her husband attain to an equal eminence, and persuaded him, though naturally of a quiet and unambitious temperament, to make the journey to Rome to crave a crown from the emperor. Agrippa, however, managed to influence Caligula against him. Antipas was deprived of his dominions and banished to Lyon, Herodias voluntarily sharing his exile. Herod Philip, son of Herod the Great by Cleopatra of Jerusalem, received the Tetrarchate of Iturea and other districts to the east and northeast of the Lake of Galilee, the poorest part of his father's kingdom. His subjects were mainly Greeks or Syrians, and his coins bear the image of Augustus or Tiberius. He is described as an excellent ruler who loved peace and was careful to maintain justice, and spent his time in his own territories. He was also a builder of cities, one of which was Caesarea Philippi, and another was Bethsaida, which he called Julius. He died after a reign of 37 years, from 4 BC until AD 34, and his dominions were incorporated in the province of Syria. Vespasian. In full, Titus Flavius Vespasianus, Roman emperor from AD 70 until 79, was born on the 18th of November, AD 9, in the Sabine country near Reate. His father was a tax collector and moneylender on a small scale. His mother was the sister of a senator. After having served with the army in Thrace and been quaestor in Crete and Cyrene, Vespasian rose to be aedile and praetor, having meanwhile married Flavia Domitilla, the daughter of a Roman knight, by whom he had two sons, Titus and Domitian, afterwards emperors. Having already served in Germany in the years 43 and 44 in the reign of Claudius, He distinguished himself in command of the 2nd Legion in Britain under Aulus Plautius. He reduced Vectis, the Isle of Wight, and penetrated to the borders of Somersetshire. In 51 he was for a brief space consul. In 63 he went as governor to Africa, where, according to Tacitus, his rule was infamous and odious. According to Suetonius, upright and highly honourable. He went with Nero's suite to Greece, and in 66 was appointed to conduct the war in Judea, which was threatening general commotion throughout the East, owing to a widely spread notion in those parts that from Judea were to come the future rulers of the world. Vespasian, who had a strong vein of superstition, was made to believe that he was himself to fulfill this expectation, and all manner of omens and oracles and portents were applied to him. He also found encouragement in Mucianus, the governor of Syria, and although a strict disciplinarian and reformer of abuses, his soldiers were thoroughly devoted to him. All eyes in the East were now upon him. Mucianus and the Syrian legions were eager to support him, and on the 1st of July, 69, while he was at Caesarea, he was proclaimed emperor, first by the army in Egypt, and then by his troops in Judea. The legions of the East at once took the customary oath of allegiance. Nevertheless, Vitellius, the occupant of the throne, had on his side the veteran legions of Gaul and Germany, Rome's best troops. But the feeling in Vespasian's favor quickly gathered strength, and the armies of Moesia, Pannonia, and Illyricum soon declared for him, and made him in fact master of half the Roman world. They entered Italy on the northeast, under the leadership of Antonius Primus, defeated the army of Vitellius at Bedriacum, sacked Cremona, and advanced on Rome, which they entered after furious fighting and a frightful confusion, in which the capital was destroyed by fire. The new emperor received the tidings of his rival's defeat and death at Alexandria, from where he at once forwarded supplies of corn to Rome, which were urgently needed, along with an edict or a declaration of policy, in which he gave assurance of an entire reversal of the laws of Nero, especially those relating to treason. While in Egypt, he became more and more imbued with superstition, consulting astrologers and allowing himself to be flattered into a belief that he possessed a divine power which could work miracles. Leaving the war in Judea to his son Titus, he arrived at Rome in 70. He at once devoted his energies to repairing the evils caused by civil war. He restored discipline in the army, which, under Vitellius, had become utterly demoralized, and, with the cooperation of the Senate, put the government and the finances on a sound footing. He renewed old taxes and instituted new, increased the tribute of the provinces, and kept a watchful eye upon the treasury officials. By his own example of simplicity of life, he put to shame the luxury and extravagance of the Roman nobles, and initiated in many respects a marked improvement in the general tone of society. As censor, he raised the character of the Senate, removing unfit and unworthy members, and promoting good and able men, among them the excellent Julius Agricola. At the same time, he made it more dependent upon the emperor by exercising an influence upon its composition. He altered the constitution of the Praetorian Guard, in which only Italians, formed into 9 cohorts, were enrolled. In 70, a formidable rising in Gaul, headed by Claudius Civilis, was suppressed, and the German frontier made secure. The Jewish War was brought to a close by Titus's capture of Jerusalem, and in the following year, after the joint triumph of Vespasian and Titus, memorable as the first occasion on which a father and son were thus associated together, the Temple of Janus was closed, and the Roman world had rest for the remaining 9 years of Vespasian's reign. The peace of Vespasian passed into a proverb. In 78, Agricola went to Britain, and both extended and consolidated the Roman dominion in that province, pushing his armies into North Wales and the Isle of Anglesey. In the following year, Vespasian died on the 23rd of June. The avarice with which both Tacitus and Suetonius stigmatize Vespasian seems really to have been an enlightened economy, which in the disordered state of the Roman finances was an absolute necessity. Vespasian could be liberal to impoverished senators and knights, to cities and towns desolated by natural calamity, and especially to men of letters and of the professor class, several of whom he pensioned. Quintilian is said to have been the first public teacher who enjoyed this imperial favor. Pliny's great work, The Natural History, was written during Vespasian's reign and dedicated to his son Titus. Some of the philosophers who talked idly of the good old times of the Republic and thus indirectly encouraged conspiracy provoked him into reviving the obsolete penal laws against this class, but only one, Helvidius Priscus, was put to death, and he had affronted the emperor by studied insults. "I will not kill a dog that barks at me," were words honestly expressing the temper of Vespasian. Much money was spent on public works and the restoration and beautifying of Rome, a new forum, the splendid temple of peace, the public baths, and the vast Colosseum being begun under Vespasian. The roads and aqueducts were repaired, and the limits of the pomerium extended. To the last, Vespasian was a plain, blunt soldier, with decided strength of character and ability, and with a steady purpose to establish good order and secure the prosperity and welfare of his subjects. In his habits, he was punctual and regular, transacting his business early in the morning and enjoying his siesta after a drive. He had not quite the distinguished bearing looked for in an emperor, but he was free in his conversation, and his humor, of which he had a good deal, was apt to take the form of rather coarse jokes. He could jest, it was said, even in his last moments. "Methinks I am becoming a god," he whispered to those around him. There is something very characteristic in the exclamation he is said to have uttered in his last illness. "An emperor ought to die standing." Titus. Flavius Sabinus Vespasianus Titus, Roman Emperor from AD 79 until 81, son of the Emperor Vespasian, was born on the 30th of December AD 40 or 41. He was educated in the imperial court and thoroughly accomplished. He could speak Greek fluently and compose verses. He was proficient in music. He could write shorthand and imitate handwriting so skillfully that he used to say that he might have been a most successful forger. He was handsome and commanding, and had a vigorous frame, well trained in all the exercises of a soldier. As a young man, he served with credit in Germany and in Britain. Soon he had the command of a legion and joined his father in Syria, where he took an active part in the Jewish war. In 68, he was sent by his father to congratulate the newly proclaimed emperor, Galba. But hearing of Galba's death and of the general confusion in the Roman world, he returned to Palestine, having in the meantime consulted the oracle of the Paphian Venus and received a favorable answer. In the following year, Vespasian, having been proclaimed emperor, returned to Italy and left Titus to carry on the siege of Jerusalem, which was captured on the 8th of September, 70. On his return to Rome, Titus and his father celebrated a magnificent triumph, which has been immortalized by the so-called Arch of Titus in Rome. He was now formally associated with his father in the government with the title of Caesar, and during the 9 remaining years of Vespasian's reign, he was, in fact, emperor. He was anything but popular. He had the character of being profligate and cruel. His connection with Berenice, the sister of the Agrippa of the Acts of the Apostles, also created a scandal. Both brother and sister followed Titus to Rome and were allowed to reside in the imperial palace. Public opinion was outraged, and Titus, though he had promised Berenice marriage, felt obliged to send her back to the east. Vespasian died in 79, leaving his son a safe throne and a well-filled treasury. The forebodings of the people were agreeably disappointed, for Titus put an end to prosecutions for high treason, and the delatores, or informers, were scourged and expelled from the city. He assumed the office of Pontifex Maximus in order that he might keep his hands free from blood. He forgave his brother, Domitian, who more than once plotted against his life, and having let a day pass without bestowing a present, he exclaimed, "I have lost a day." Titus, like his father, spent money in adding to the magnificence of Rome. The Flavian Amphitheatre, later called the Colosseum, was completed and dedicated in his reign, with combats of gladiators, shows of wild beasts, and representations of some of the great Greek naval battles. He gave the city splendid baths, which surpassed those of Agrippa and of Nero, and supplied the mob with every kind of luxury. During his reign, in 79, occurred the eruption of Vesuvius, which destroyed Herculaneum and Pompeii. The emperor visited the scenes and contributed liberally to the relief of the distressed inhabitants. During his absence, a fire raged for 3 days at Rome, in which the new temple of Jupiter Capitolinus, the library of Augustus, and other public buildings were burnt. Then followed a pestilence, and Titus again assisted freely with his purse. Italy and the Roman world were peaceful during his reign. The only fighting was in Britain under Agricola, who in the year 80 carried the Roman arms as far as the Tyre. Titus died on the 13th of September, 81. The verdict of history is favorable to him, but the general feeling throughout the Roman world was that he had been fortunate in the briefness of his reign. Joseph ben Matthias, also known as Flavius Josephus, Jewish historian and military commander, was born in the first year of Caligula in AD 37 or 38. His father belonged to one of the noblest priestly families, and through his mother he claimed descent from the Asmonean high priest Jonathan. A precocious student of the law, he made trial of the three sects of Judaism, Pharisees, Sadducees, and Essenes, before he reached the age of 19. Then, having spent 3 years in the desert with the hermit Barnabas, who was presumably an Essene, he became a Pharisee. In 64, he went to Rome to intercede on behalf of some priests, his friends, whom the procurator, Felix, had sent to render account to Caesar for some insignificant offense. Making friends with Alatyrus, a Jewish actor, who was a favorite of Nero, Josephus obtained an introduction to the Empress Poppaea, and effected his purpose by her help. His visit to Rome enabled him to speak from personal experience of the power of the empire when he expostulated with the revolutionary Jews on his return to Palestine. But they refused to listen, and he, with all the Jews who did not fly the country, was dragged into the great rebellion of 66. In company with two other priests, Josephus was sent to Galilee under orders, he says, to persuade the ill-affected to lay down their arms and return to the Roman allegiance, which the Jewish aristocracy had not yet renounced. Having sent his two companions back to Jerusalem, he organized the forces at his disposal and made arrangements for the government of his province. His obvious desire to preserve law and order excited the hostility of John of Giscala, who endeavored vainly to remove him as a traitor to the national cause by inciting the Galileans to kill him, and by persuading the Sanhedrin at Jerusalem to recall him. In the spring of 67, the Jewish troops, whom Josephus had drilled so sedulously, fled before the Roman forces of Vespasian and Titus. He sent to Jerusalem for reinforcements, but none came. With the stragglers who remained, he held a stronghold against the Romans by dint of his native cunning, and finally, when the place was taken, persuaded 40 men who shared his hiding place to kill one another in turn, rather than commit suicide. They agreed to cast lots on the understanding that the second should kill the first, and so on. Josephus providentially drew the last lot and prevailed upon his destined victim to live. Their companions were all dead in accordance with the compact, but Josephus at any rate survived and surrendered. Being led before Vespasian, he was inspired to prophesy that Vespasian would become emperor. In consequence of the prophecy, his life was spared, but he was kept close prisoner for 2 years. When his prophecy was fulfilled, he was liberated, assumed the name of Flavius, the family name of Vespasian, and accompanied his patron to Alexandria. There he took another wife, as the Jewess allotted him by Vespasian after the fall of Caesarea had forsaken him, and returned to attend Titus and to act as intermediary between him and the Jews who still held Jerusalem. His efforts in this capacity failed, but when the city was stormed in 70, Titus granted him whatever boon he might ask. So he secured the lives of some free men who had been taken, and, by the gift of Titus, certain sacred books. After this, he repaired to Rome and received one of the pensions, which Vespasian, according to Suetonius, was the first to bestow upon Latin and Greek writers. He was also made a Roman citizen and received an estate in Judea. Thenceforward, he devoted himself to literary work under the patronage of Vespasian, Titus, and Domitian. As he mentions the death of Agrippa II, it is probable that he lived into the 2nd century. But the date of Agrippa's death has been challenged, and if his patron, Epaphroditus, may be identified with Nero's freedman, it is possible that Josephus may have been involved in his fall and perished under Domitian in 95. The Jewish War, the oldest of Josephus's extant writings, was written towards the end of Vespasian's reign. The Aramaic original has not been preserved, but the Greek version was prepared by Josephus himself in conjunction with competent Greek scholars. Its purpose, in all probability, was, in the first instance, to exhibit to the Babylonian Jews the overwhelming power of Rome, and so to deter them from repeating the futile revolt of the Jews of Palestine. Of its second books, the first two survey the history of the Jews from the capture of Jerusalem by Antiochus Epiphanes to the outbreak of war in 67. And here Josephus relies upon some such general history as that of Nicolaus of Damascus. The rest deals with the events of the war, which lasted from 67 until 73, which fell more or less within his own knowledge. Vespasian, Titus, and Agrippa II testified, he tells us, to his accuracy. Representatives of the Zealots would probably have protested against his pro-Roman prejudices.